Alan Lewis versus Commonwealth.
Yes, Your Honor.
Ms. Ames, you have 15 minutes. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I have a quick question. The docket did say you're actually 40 minutes.
It is 40 minutes because I take that back. Please put it at 20 minutes.
Okay.
Because this is the consolidated appeal.
Yes, sir. And in that case, I would ask to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
That is my fault. Although nobody should feel obligated to talk for the full 20 if you can finish quicker than that.
Yes, Your Honor. Duly noted.
But you have the full 20 and you may use it any way you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please report again, Samantha Offit Thames with the Richard Paul Defender's Office on behalf of Alan Leon Lewis. Your Honor, in this case, this court should dismiss Mr. Lewis's conviction for possession of a firearm by a convicted felon as his case was heard outside his constitutional and statutory trial rights. In this case, it seems as though we're coming down to the main issue of whether or not Mr. Lewis timely objected to the Commonwealth's ex parte removal of his case from the docket. And in this case, he did. Under Virginia Code Section 19.2-2434, it is on the defendant to note an objection to any continuance that the defendant does not agree to. And in this case, Mr. Lewis did object on November 17, 2016, at the bond motion.
Viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, which is our standard given the posture we find ourselves in, does the record support an inference that the parties appeared in some way, shape, or form at the November 2016 docket call and agreed to set the case for March 27, 2017 trial? All right.
There's nothing in the record.
A lack of evidence in the record generally does not work to an appellant's benefit.
Yes,
sir. But the two specific pieces of things I want to ask you about in the record that seem to potentially give rise to such an inference is the order on the bond motion refers to the trial date having been previously scheduled, which would be odd if that was the order that actually scheduled the matter for trial. It wouldn't be previously scheduled, it would say scheduled. And then in the speedy trial motion itself, it notes that it seems to note that the case was set at docket, that an agreed date was selected at docket call, not a I was available and they imposed the date on me, but it was an agreed date.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Why do those two things not suggest it was set at docket call?
Well, first, there is no record out of docket call, Richmond's docket call. So for the appellant to have a requirement to create one is not within our ability. There is no court orders generated out of docket call. There are no court orders generated docket call. There are no court reporters at docket call. There are no judges at docket call. Defendants are not transported at docket call, nor defendants required to be at docket call, except for in certain very narrow circumstances with direct indictments. So for us to have to create a record out of that would be, at this point, impossible. Well,
but
from this record...
Didn't you create the record, or didn't the appellant create the record himself at the time of filing the motion to dismiss when it was stated that it had been set?
Yes, Your Honor. We did, in this case, include the email correspondence and also the paragraph that both judges are referring to is also very explicit in that paragraph in the motions to, or the, I forget how it was termed, the supporting documentation or motion to dismiss. Within that paragraph, the defense counsel also notes that they explicitly objected on November 17th to the date, and then below that said it was set to an agreed date.
But the agreed date was set before the bond hearing on November 17th, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. It sounds as though there was an agreement of some sort about a date, but the defense counsel still objected, and that the fact that defense counsel did object on November 17th, the fact that it was ultimately set to an agreed date at that point does not waive that objection. So at this point...
I guess the question is, and I agree with you that the statute sets, it's the defendant's duty to object, and in your brief you've hit that theme and said, and we did object. Implicit in the duty to object is the duty to timely object.
Yes.
You couldn't have waited until after the trial to then object, obviously.
Yes, sir.
And so the question is, if the case and the emails that are attached to the motion establish that it was continued to the docket call, why is it, if the case was set at that docket call, why isn't that the time when the objection has to be raised? As opposed to, we agree to the date, and then 10 days later, we finally say we object. But believe me, the process by which we got here was wrong for your client. The ex parte, but with what we have, why isn't the docket call the time to object?
There's no judges present, Your Honor, so there's no one to object to at docket call. And at that point...
Can't you get one?
No.
Why not?
I don't believe so. My understanding of Richmond docket call is that the judges aren't there. It's the judges' digital secretaries, and that's it. So to object to docket call would be objecting to a scheduling event.
I don't want to go outside the record, but I've worked in that courthouse for a long time. There are plenty of judges in the room. Why not go get one?
Your Honor, that is something that would happen here. I personally would not pull a judge for docket call. My understanding is that there are no judges present at docket call, period. And in this case, Mr. Lewis did attempt to obtain a bond motion at very first instance that they could in order to object. This was also not a typical continuance, as the court does allude to, because it was removed from the docket by a common attorney not remotely associated with Mr. Lewis's case, and Mr. Lewis was not informed until defense trial counsel submitted her jury instructions 3 days before trial. So the
appellant, the defendant then, knew of this change in court date even before the date of the docket call.
And she attempted to obtain an actual court date.
When the record that we have before us indicates that it was set without objection, at least.
Your Honor, she attempted to get before the court as soon as she could at that point. The fastest date that she could get before the court was the November 17th date. I think that's also very clear in the record, that was the very first date that they... Actually, I'm sorry, November 16th was, and then the defendant wasn't transported.
Was the case set by email, or did people actually appear, or do we not know?
We don't know. I don't know, Your Honor. Personally.
So we don't know if she appeared or not.
No.
And so...
And there's no... The only thing in this record is the order from the bond motion, and at that point, Mr. Lewis
And the motion for speedy trial.
Yes. And at that point, at the bond motion, Mr. Lewis explicitly objected to the Commonwealth's ex parte removal, and then in that order, the court noted for the very first time the March date. I also note for the court that on November 17th, this matter could have been set within speedy trial. It could have been, the objection could have been fully noted. The matter could have been set for a number of months before then, but yet it was still set out in March. And under this court's case law, it is only to the defense to object to the continuance. It is not for the defense. The defense can then agree to a date that works. But the defense noted their objection.
But that sequencing is important. I'm going to ask you a hypothetical. I want you to assume that Mr. Lewis's counsel and the Commonwealth appeared at docket call. And at the docket call said, we agreed, presented to the court, without any indication of an objection whatsoever, an agreement of March 27th to 2017 for the trial date. And an express agreement. We agree to this date, I'm available, but an express agreement. Assuming that set of facts, would a November 17th objection be timely?
Your Honor, it's hard to answer that question because it's also not what we have here. There's no record created from docket call, so there's no way to know that actually happened. So I guess you're assuming also that there is a judge present in the court.
I don't care whether the judge present or not.
Okay.
I just want to say that you've appeared before whoever is doing the docket call.
Mm-hmm.
To assume that counsel has appeared before him and says, we agree to this date, and does not interpose any type of objection, doesn't raise any problem, doesn't raise speedy trial, says, we agree to the trial date. If that happened, is an objection 10 days after the agreed date timely? And if so, why?
I think that it could still be considered timely by this court because there is no limitation from the statute or the case law as to what timely is. I still also would point out for the court that even at November 17th, the matter could have been still be set within speedy trial very easily. So in this case, the reason why it was pulled was because of a superseding murder, and then it wasn't set within 4 months after that all happened.
If you take it outside of this case, if a defendant expressly agrees without any objection to a trial date outside of speedy trial, under the statute, has he waived speedy trial even if he raises it later?
I would still argue that the court should consider the later objection, but I obviously have not fully looked into that, Your Honor. But
okay.
I would still argue that in this case, the only thing we have as far as an actual record goes from the trial court and who speaks through his record is that bond order from the November 17th date, which is the date where Mr. Lewis' counsel clearly, unequivocally objected. She said, we never came to court to remove this case from the docket, so I wanted to note for the record that we do object to the continuance. She was abundantly clear.
You agree that Mr. Lewis, for the purposes of appeal, is bound to the representations made by his counsel in the speedy trial motion, that he can rise no higher than that?
Yes, Your Honor, but I still believe that in that motion, she's very clear, because the paragraph, the way it's structured, is at first talking about the bond motion. I believe, if we're talking about the same paragraph, I'm sorry, Your Honor, but in the top part of the paragraph, I'm confident we are. Top of the paragraph, she notes that she explicitly objected on November 17th, and then the matter was set to an agreed date. So under this court's case law in Baker versus Commonwealth, along with another series of cases, an eventual agreement does not waive the first objection. So she did object, and the fact that she didn't then stick her heels in and refuse to have the case set, period, is not a waiver of his speedy trial rights. And it would also, if the court were to set that standard, would mean that a lot of cases would be maybe getting some defense counsel into trouble down the road. But she eventually did agree to a date. She did her obligation. She noted her objection for the court, and then the court overruled her objection, set the matter out 4 more months into March, and then at that point in March, she asked for the case to be dismissed based off speedy trial grounds. She completed all of her obligations, and I also emphasize to the court once again that this was not a typical continuance. This was a continuance where defense counsel was given no notice, her case was fully removed from the docket, there was no more court date. So this was a case not where she had come before a judge and did not object at that point. The matter was flatly removed from underneath her. So in this case, she did in fact note her objection as she is required to do so. The trial court also misapplied some of the law in its ruling, and it confused the burden here. The burden remains with the Commonwealth. And at that point, especially at the November 17th date, the matter could have and should have been set within speedy trial, and yet the Commonwealth nor the court took it upon themselves to set it within speedy trial. So the court misapplies that here, and also it is not to Lewis to file, for example, a written objection at that point, because his sole obligation is to object. He did, in fact, object. Moreover, Your Honors, in this case, there isn't a sufficiently valid reason put forward as to why the matter was set out into March. There's nothing in the record to say why that happened, other than the fact that that was eventually the date that parties could have agreed to. There's no reason why it couldn't have been set for another 4 months, well within speedy trial in this case. Your Honor, this also, if there's no other further questions about that, this also violated Mr. Lewis's constitutional speedy rights. The length of the delay is the first opening part of this. This case did go on for a substantial period of time. While Mr. Lewis had asked for a number of the continuances himself, at the end of the day, this case still went on for 1 year and 7 months. So that is still within what would consider to be something that must be analyzed by this court. And the reason for this delay was also one that would weigh in Mr. Lewis's favor under Wingo, because this was because of overcrowded courts. There's no other reason. Mr. Lewis was double stacked, for lack of a better word, and his case got ex parte removed simply because a murder case, as the other Commonwealth attorney said, took precedence. So it got bumped.
From the motion that was filed, the memorandum in support of speedy trial, that motion that was filed,
yes, sir.
Do you agree that paragraph 14 makes clear, establishes that the parties appeared at docket call?
No, Your Honor. I mean, it says defense case went to docket call.
And was set for a bond hearing?
Yes.
Okay. How would it have been set for a bond hearing if the parties weren't present? Either by telephone, by available date?
If we look at the strict reading of the paragraph, Your Honor, it just says that the case went to docket call. There is nothing in this record other than that to indicate what happened at docket call.
Do you think it's a reasonable inference to conclude from that paragraph that the parties appeared in some way, shape, or form at docket call?
Your Honor, given the way that Richmond docket call works, I don't know who appeared at docket call, to be perfectly frank. There's no record.
Right, and I understand there's not a record. And so the question is, if that's all we have in the record, what's a reasonable inference to draw from that?
That Mr. Lewis's case passed through docket call, and a date for the bond motion was set. So I guess I guess.
And it turned out that every, I mean, and given that it turned out that everybody was available on the date that was set, in fact, all the lawyers showed up. The reason it didn't happen was he wasn't transported. But it would certainly seem that the lawyers had to have been aware of what happened at DACA call because they showed up.
Yes, Your Honor. I also would point out, though, that DACA call still does not have a judge present. So in order for anyone to object to anything, I do think it would be meaningless, short of digging in heels and refusing to have anything be set at DACA call.
Could you say, we don't agree that this is within speedy trial, but we are available on this, and we would ask that this be reflected in whatever the court, whatever is prepared by the court. Could you say that? Not asking whether that would result in anything, but could that be said?
It could be said, but they don't create orders out of DACA call, so nothing would be generated. So that's the
ultimate
problem.
I'm not confident that if that was said, that nothing would be generated.
Your Honor, I personally don't know, and from my understanding, though, from Richmond DACA call, I don't think it would have generated anything. Beyond the fact that it's still, there's no judges present at DACA call, there's no record created out of DACA call, we really don't know what happened at DACA call. The first order we have was from a date where Mr. Lewis was, in fact, in front of a judge, did, in fact, object, and the court overruled her objection, or more fittingly, kind of didn't address it at all and just set the matter out to March. So in this case, I do understand the court's point about DACA call. However, there simply is just nothing in this record from DACA call. All we do have is the order, and the court speaks through its orders. And beyond just going in and refusing to have anything set, Your Honor, I would also note that this was set to November DACA call without Mr. Lewis's involvement whatsoever.
I'm aware.
At that point, it would be hard for Mr. Lewis to do anything about it. I do believe I'm in my rebuttal time, so I would reserve my remarks for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Curry.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Liam Curry on behalf of the Commonwealth in this matter. Addressing the first assignment of error, the Commonwealth sees that this case, that assignment of error involves a simple question: whether an objection to a continuance that was made 31 days after the trial was removed from the docket, and that was made 10 days after an agreed-upon new trial date had been selected, can be considered timely.
What evidence is there in this record that supports an inference that the matter was actually set for trial at docket call?
I think two things that were already discussed in my opposing counsel's argument. First is the bond motion that specifically notes that the matter had been previously set. It doesn't state that at that hearing on November 17th that the parties had a meeting of the minds and agreed to a new trial date. It specifically notes that it was previously set.
That order says that, but paragraph 16, and I think that you may not be bound by what's in. They may be bound in the motion, and maybe you're not, but paragraph 16 of the motion at page 47 of the joint appendix. On November 17, 2016, the defendant was given a personal recognizance bond, and the case was continued to March 27, 2017. The normal reading of that would be that the case was set for trial on November 17th, would it not?
That would be the normal reading of it, Your Honor, but I think it contradicts the plain language of the court's written order from that date. And additionally, in support of that, as just on the previous page, Appendix 46, Note 14 of the same motion, I think it's clear that you can infer from this paragraph that the parties appeared at the docket call. Otherwise, there would be no need to have the docket call. The court could just arbitrarily select a date, and then if the parties objected to that date based on unavailability, they could make that known at a later time. But the whole purpose of a docket call is for the parties to show up with their calendars to allow a matter to be scheduled. And so I think it's a reasonable inference from this record that both parties, or both counsel, appeared at that docket call. And I believe that inference is also supported by the fact that counsel further appeared at the November 16th bond hearing that had to be continued as well.
You will agree that the matter was initially continued in an inappropriate manner.
I do agree with that, Your Honor.
Right. The trial court almost seemed to suggest that at some point during your brief that it was incumbent upon them, having been the victim of an ex parte communication that should never have happened, to the minute they find out about it, file something, when what they found out was it had been continued to docket call. What is the Attorney General's position as to would it have been a timely objection if they had objected at docket call?
I believe it would have to be considered a timely objection at that point.
They didn't have to file anything before then. They could wait until docket call to object.
Well, I guess if I could just back up a few days on the calendar, Your Honor, to address that question. I think when the obligation to object begins, I think, obviously, if I can check my dates here, it looks like the matter was removed without notice to Mr. Lewis on October 12th. And from my reading of the record, it appears that Lewis's counsel became aware that the matter had been continued on October 17th. I think at that point, the defendant, through counsel, has actual notice of the fact that the matter has been continued. So I think prior to that date, I don't think anyone would argue that, or I don't think you can even argue that there was an obligation to object prior to that time. I think with actual knowledge, I think it would be a reasonable interpretation of this court that as of that date, you're starting to tread the line carefully about whether it's timely or not. I think another kind of target date for a timely objection would also be the original trial date. I think if on the original trial date, Mr. Lewis had presented a motion to the court saying, you know, as the court is aware, this matter was set for trial on this date. As the court is also aware, the matter was removed from the docket without notice or the consent of the defendant, and I would like to object to that continuance via this written objection or motion. And that didn't happen in this case. I think what the absolute cutoff has to be, though, is at some point just before or contemporaneous to the agreeing to the new trial date. Because as the speedy trial law the speedy trial law of Virginia makes clear, in the normal course of things, there must be a motion for a continuance, and then for the defendant to preserve his speedy trial rights, he must object to the granting of that continuance under 19.2.243, subsection 4. And then once that objection has been noted, the selection of an agreed trial date has no impact on that objection. The objection has been preserved for speedy trial purposes. So while the continuance is not the way anyone would have wanted it to occur, I think the obligation of Mr. Lewis to object prior to the selection of a new trial date has been established by prior speedy trial precedent. And the application of that precedent to this matter would require this court to affirm, having found that Mr. Lewis failed to file a timely objection to the continuance of his trial date. The Commonwealth's position, if the court wants to speak to this issue on speedy trial, is that there was no violation of his statutory speedy trial rights, that Mr. Lewis Mr. Lewis had been granted significant continuances totaling over 254 days, and the Commonwealth's position is that he acquiesced by his failure to object to a period of approximately 140 days, meaning that a significant matter of the delay in his criminal trial was attributable to him. On the revocation issues, again, the Commonwealth's position is that there was no speedy trial violation.
Does that issue rise or fall with the resolution of the speedy trial?
No, it does not, Your Honor.
All right. What evidence of the underlying offense, as opposed to simply the conviction, was before the trier of fact on the revocation?
The Commonwealth's position is that all of the evidence of the underlying offense could have been before the trial court.
No. That wasn't my question.
Okay.
Yes, it could have been. What was presented to the court on revocation, was it just, and we have the new conviction, or did they put on evidence of the underlying offense.
And if, just as a point of a clarification, you're referring to what was presented as a separate issue from what the trial court actually considered?
At the revocation here. It was given a separate case number. It's got a separate case number here. What was done in that proceeding?
In that proceeding, the Commonwealth attorney reminded the trial court that Mr. Lewis had been convicted, I think it was only perhaps 3 months prior, for the unlawful firearm possession by a violent felon conviction. And the trial court stated that he remembered that case because he was the judge on the bench for the defendant's trial. The Commonwealth attorney, I believe, also stated that the incident that resulted in that second conviction was Mr. Lewis having brought a firearm into a reporting center, and that was the basis of his conviction. However, I think there are more significant problems with the assignments of error 2 and 3. One, I don't think it's accurate to state that the trial court relied solely on the existence of the conviction, the unlawful firearm possession conviction, as a basis for revoking Mr. Lewis's entire suspended time. The court expressly stated its reasons, and I believe that is on... The trial court expressly states its reasons on appendix page 129. Those included that of the five-year sentence that Mr. Lewis was ordered sentenced to in the original conviction, he was only required to serve 3 months of that sentence, indicating that he received a leniency upon his first conviction. The court noted that it was Mr. Lewis's second violation of the terms of that suspended sentence. And the court also noted that when he had violated the terms of his suspended sentence the first time, the court only revoked an additional 3 months of his suspended time. So of his five-year sentence, he'd only been ordered to serve 6 months. And the court also found that it was revoking his entire remaining time because he had seven prior felony convictions. Those were, I think it's clear that the trial, for lack of a better term, the revocation court was laying out a record to establish that it was not relying on Mr. Lewis's conviction that's the subject of the speedy trial claim. I think he articulated several reasons in support of his decision, and I think that that the defendant has failed to establish that that was an abuse of his discretion to revoke his remaining time. My opponent has cited to the Rezio case, but the Rezio case also states that when it plainly appears in the record that the trial court did not rely on any sort of improper evidence to sentence the defendant, the alleged error was harmless. Obviously, the Commonwealth's primary position is that there was no improper consideration of the speedy trial statute, that it appears that there was no improper consideration of the speedy trial conviction that's being challenged. There was no speedy trial violation in that case. So there's really no way that the court could have erred. I think that addresses all of the Mr. Lewis's arguments. If the court has any further questions it wishes for me to address, I'd be happy to address them. Otherwise, I'll cede my time to the court and ask this court to affirm the judgments below. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Thames.
Yes, Your Honors. While Rezio did ultimately say at first that it was harmless because there was another conviction, actually, that Mr. Rezio never ever appealed, the court then went on to say that because the two convictions that were appealed and were reversed clearly impacted the sentencing, then the probation violation had to go back. And that's what we are basing this off of, is there are clearly other parts to the probation violation, clearly in the letter and as the Attorney General indicated.
When the Commonwealth referenced and asked the trial court to recall the jury trial, and the trial court said, I recall that, there was no objection to the trial court relying on its memory, was there?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, but there still was no evidence put forward at the guilt innocence phase of the probation violation about what actually happened, and that's what I do mean by bare or base introduction of conviction. I don't mean that there was that was it. In this case, there clearly was also a major violation letter in this case indicating positive drug tests as well as a lack of communication with the probation officer. But in this case, at the guilt innocence phase, the Commonwealth attorney simply said he was convicted. And there's no additional evidence put forward at that point about what happened in that case. And I do think it would be inappropriate for the trial court to rely solely on its memory. I know there's no objection, but
I don't necessarily disagree with you that it would be inappropriate for the trial court to rely on its memory, but when the trial court says, I recall that.
And, Your Honor, if you could direct me towards a page number, because at the same point, this probation violation did wander between guilt, innocence, and then into sentencing rather quickly. And there was a bunch of conversation back and forth between the Commonwealth attorney and the court, where the Commonwealth attorney also noted for the court that this matter was on appeal, and he wanted him held pending that appeal to make sure he was held. So I do think that the sentence...
124. Judge, I would have one addition to the violation letter. I'm not sure if the probation officer filed an addendum or not.
Yes.
Your Honor, you may recall that Mr. Lewis was tried before a jury back on March 27th for possession of a firearm by a convicted felon and was in fact found guilty and sentenced to 5 years.
And I recall that.
I recall that.
Yes, sir. Also, I would say that there is no information put forward in that proffer by the Palm attorney about the actual facts. So what we're left with is that he remembered he was convicted of by a jury.
Well, except so. Given that he was the, what he's saying is I was the, couldn't it be read that he's saying I sat here and heard all of that?
Or it could be read that I read his record and I recall that he was convicted of a jury, by the jury of a...
But we know he was, in fact, the trial judge.
I believe he was, Your Honor.
The appeals are consolidated. Hairston had them both.
Yes. He was, but also by the reading, also can read that he simply did recall that he was, in fact, convicted. So it could also be, I recall the bare conviction and the 5 years he was given. And in this case, because he ran the time concurrent to the time he got from the jury, it's clear that the sentence was impacted by the conviction because he essentially backed up the time as the Commonwealth attorney asked him to do. So therefore, because we still maintain that this was beyond his speedy trial rights, once this court properly dismisses the conviction, they should be reversed. The probation violation should be remanded as well.
But you did stipulate to the trial court, or the appellant did stipulate to the trial court that he had violated the terms of the suspended sentence.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. And so did. And Rezio also didn't appeal one conviction, which is a basis for a probation violation. And in Whitehead as well, there's other bases that she pled guilty to that then also the court said because we reversed the convictions, the probation violation has to go back. So there are cases under this court where even if they were to admit or never appeal a conviction, for example, if the sentence was still impacted by the conviction, this court says send it back. And in this case, we'd argue that the court should send it back. And also just quickly note that this was not in the normal course of things. This matter was removed ex parte from the docket. He did object as soon as he could and 4 days before court. And I would ask the court to dismiss the conviction and to reverse remand the probation violation.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your argument. We'll